supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. 15 years ago, an American Psychological Association study estimated that the average child sees 10,000 murders, rapes, and aggravated assaults per year. That was 15 years ago. Add to that the message children get about gender and sexual identity. So what's the impact of all this media? Well, that's what we're going to discuss today with Dr. Amy Jordan. Jordan is the director of the Developing Child Sector at Annenberg, and she's co-author of Children and Adolescents and the Media. Amy Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Dan.
And if you're concerned about your child's relationship with the media and the media's relationship with your child, give us a call. That's 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Amy, let's begin by talking about those statistics. I'd like to break them down and understand what they really mean. First of all, small children see a lot of violence in cartoons. They always have. I remember there was an uproar about the Three Stooges when I was a kid. So is it different now?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily different today that children are watching programs that aren't necessarily intended for them. There's a lot of television on during the household. Nielsen Research Company estimates that the average home with young children has a TV on for about 8 hours a day. And most of what's on in the background isn't really meant for kids' eyes. It's meant for the adults who are watching news or their favorite programming. So no, the amount of exposure that children have to violence hasn't gone away. But I do think that our awareness of the potential impact of these kinds of exposures has increased, and that's a good thing.
So let's talk about that. And that is the big question everybody worries about. Does violence in the media increase the risk for our children acting out with violence?
Well, it depends on how we define acting out. Certainly, children who are exposed to violence in the media are more likely to see the world as a kind of scarier place, particularly if it resonates with their own environment, if they live in a domestic setting where there's violence or in a community where there's violence. And for some children, under some conditions, being exposed to violence in cartoons like Power Rangers is more likely to make them aggressive or combative, particularly as they're solving problems.
That's regardless of their environment?
Regardless of their environment, there are some children, particularly boys, who are of a certain age, 6, 7, 8 years old, who like to imitate what they see and are more likely to see that as a realistic way to solve a problem.
I wonder if that lasts.
No, it typically doesn't. Children, as they grow older, are exposed to other ways of solving problems. And for some children, growing up in families where they can, where their parents are talking to them about what they're seeing, that certainly can mitigate what they're seeing. Parents who watch a violent cartoon alongside their child can say, "Well, you know, this is television. This isn't reality. This isn't how we are in the world. We don't talk like that. We don't act like that."
I also wonder about the sexuality small children are exposed to, and that's particularly troubling to me. I mean, what's rated PG today might have almost been soft porn 50 years ago.
Yeah, there is a lot on television, on broadcast television, that for adults makes us raise our eyebrows. We don't know, as researchers, how much of this children actually process, how much of it goes over their head, and how much of it they think, well, this is how adults or teenagers act based on what they're seeing on television. And there's a practical reason why we don't know a lot of it. We can't do the experiments where we show children these things and then ask them about
that's
it.
True.
But we have done some surveys, one that we're doing here at the Annenberg Public Policy Center, where we track adolescent exposure to sexuality in the media. And when we say media, we mean television and movies for sure, but also magazines and music content, video games. And studies that have been done at other universities, including the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and a study by the RAND Corporation, suggests that it does affect youth, that they do, they are more likely to become sexually active at an earlier age if they're exposed to a lot of sex in the media. We're still trying to puzzle out the extent to which exposure to sex in the media creates a set of beliefs and behaviors that might put youth at risk, or youth who are interested in sex selectively expose themselves to media that kind of suit their interests.
Well, one way of looking at it, I interviewed years ago a bunch of teenagers about violent video games, and one kid said something to me that was telling about the violence. He said, it bothered me at first, but now I kind of get used to it and it feels normal.
Yeah, that's what we call desensitization in the communications field. That after many, many exposures, children just don't get the same racing heart and sweaty palms and nightmares that they maybe once got when they were first exposed to it. I think it's not a good thing. I think we always want to be upset when we see violence and injustice like that in our world. It should be upsetting. They shouldn't be getting used to it. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I don't want my daughter to see scary horror films, because certainly she'll get nightmares at first, but over time she probably desensitized to it. But I don't think that should happen. I think right. We should be upset by horror.
I agree. But desensitization is not always a bad thing. After all, those who work with anxiety disorders and OCD, that's exactly what they use. That's the name of the therapy is desensitization. So there's some things we want to remain sensitive to.
Right.
I want to look developmentally. How do teenagers integrate what they're seeing in the media? And is there a difference between TV and video games?
Well, it depends on the content. Certainly television is more of a passive media where we're watching a flow of images that's unfolding in a time that's usually predicted by whoever's broadcasting the television show, although with on-demand and other DVDs, we can stop and start it, but we're not determining the outcome. Whereas with a video game, you're choosing your player, you're choosing what direction you want to take your player in, what weapons he's using, or what direction he's going in. So it's more interactive. And there are researchers who study the effects of violent video games who say because it's more engaging that way, and because you're the one that's shooting, we call them first-person shooter games, it has the potential to have a greater impact. We know it does change attitudes. It makes the players' hearts go faster, and makes them physiologically respond more strongly than if they were just watching it on television. But we don't actually know how it might be affecting their behavior. There have been a few events, we call them focusing events, where we say we can trace this behavior back to video game playing. I'm thinking of Columbine and some of the video games that the perpetrators of Columbine were playing. But the connecting those dots is tenuous at best. It's really not clear that one caused the other.
And, you know, I come back to the issue that you referred to earlier about desensitization. And, you know, you talked about the sweaty palms and the rapid heartbeat when they play these games. But once they get desensitized, they're actually looking for the sweaty palms and rapid heartbeat. So they need more violence. It's almost like addiction. Physiologically, it's very similar.
Well, I think, the bar is raised when our culture as a whole gets less sensitive to sex and violence at lower levels than advertisers and producers and scriptwriters, they feel like they have to add more and more and more in, so it catches the attention of gamers or audiences. But one might also argue that for some video games, and there is an author that argues this, his name is Steven Johnson, once you're past being sensitive to the blood and gore, you start to engage in the game in another more critically and cognitively engaged way.
What do you mean?
Well, when you're playing a video game, it does call up certain kinds of skills. You need to be able to think on a kind of meta level about what you want your character to do, what the goals are, how to get your character from point A to point B. Sometimes that involves weapons. Sometimes it involves a lot of strategizing. You know, certainly gamers are developing skills as they're practicing for hours and hours and hours on end. So I think it's important to recognize that for most media, there is bad content that we worry about, but there may be some positive side effects.
Well, like, go on.
Like getting attached to a character and kind of developing empathy for a character, or thinking carefully through how you're going to beat this level and ultimately beat the game.
Well, you know, the other great asset also, is, as an aside, is metacognition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a great asset for kids, for all of us, to be able to think about our thinking.
Right. And in thinking about our thinking, we can use the media as fodder for that. So one of the things that parents can do when they're consuming media, let's say a television show or a movie with kids, is to say, well, what do you think is going to happen? How do you think this will end? And then get at, with the child, why they think that's happening. And then we begin to see that the child is developing, through their use of media, maybe narrative thinking skills. Like, this is the beginning, and the character will go through a conflict, and then the conflict will be resolved, and this is usually how it ends. And for younger children, they really like the predictability of that, and they feel smart and masterful at being able to say, this is how it's going to end, and being right about it, which is partly why they watch the same DVD over and over and over again when they're 3, 4, or 5 years old.
Well, that's pretty much why we tell the same stories we tell about what's real and what's not real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's Dr. Amy Jordan. She's director of the Developing Child Sector at Annenberg. She's written Children, Adolescents, and the Media. That's what we're talking about, our kids' relationship to the media, its impact on them. We were, if you, oh, by the way, if you want to join our conversation, I forgot to give out the phone numbers, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Amy, you know, we were talking about violent video games that adolescents are playing. Let's go to the other end of the continuum, because, you know, young children now are getting involved in video games. There's a game that I learned about this week in preparing for the show called Webkinz.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to hear an interview. One of my producers, Elisa Walters, interviewed 7-year-old Anthony about the online game of Webkinz. This is a virtual reality game in which children care for store-bought stuffed animals online. Elise also spoke with his mom, Jennifer, about how her children's online use affects the family. If you listen in the background, after Anthony's done talking, you'll hear he's playing his Webkinz in the background. So let's listen to this interview.
What kind of Webkinz do you have?
German Shepherd, Alley Cat, Manatee, Rhino, Google, and Gorilla.
You go to the store and you buy these pets. How do you get them online?
You get your tag, cut it off, open it, press new member, and put your code on, pick your name, and you adopt your pet.
Okay, so we're on the main website. Where do you go next? What do you do?
Press login.
Okay, so log in there for me. How did you learn about these Webkinz?
My sister.
Oh, and do you know how your sister learned about them?
I think it was her friends that told her.
So is this a big thing of with kids your age? Everyone has Webkinz?
Some of them.
Explain to me what you'll do now. You've signed online, you have your 14 Webkinz here that you have to take care of. What are you going to do?
Feed my Webkin.
Okay, so tell me how you go about feeding your Webkin.
You could go to the W shop, make your Webkins, and then go to this other thing.
Mom, tell me about these Webkins. Seems like he's quite addicted.
Yeah, he is. I really like it, though, for them. I think it's something good and responsible for them to do on the internet. And they learn how to take care of things, and it's safe, and I like that about it, too.
What do you know about it?
I know that they could go on, they buy their pets, and they put their coat on, and they feed them, they take care of them, they have to exercise them. There's games that they play, and they earn money towards buying stuff for their pets. So,
how much time would you say Anthony spends online with the Webkinz?
In the summertime, he had spent longer on it. Now that he's back in school, it'd be anywhere from like a half hour to 45 minutes a day.
How do you educate your kids on the sites that they can go on and steering clear of the sites that they shouldn't go on, and just the education of online safety in general?
I'm very open with my children, and I explain to them that there are a lot of bad people out there, you know, that try to go on and pretend like they're kids. And, you know, at any time the subject would come up in the news, you know, I sit the kids down and I will explain to them that this could happen to you, and, you know, they have to watch and they have to be careful. And, you know, I there are certain websites that they do have for kids that I won't allow them to get on because of just the different types of people you can meet on there.
How is the internet influencing their education, influencing the way that they socialize with their friends, and just their lives in general?
I think the internet is good educational-wise. They could get on there, you know, with their reports, or they get on there to learn things. They Google a lot. You know, they'll Google a lot of history facts, you know, just to find things out. The internet, when we were younger, really wasn't what it is today. You know, and I think our generation had more interacting with kids outside playing. You know, I think a lot of parents allow their kids to really sit at the computer a lot, and I really don't think that's that good.
That was Elisa Walters interviewing 7-year-old Anthony about Webkinz and his mom, Jennifer, about the impact the computer, the internet, has on the family. We're going to hear more from Jennifer later in the show. So, Amy Jordan, first, what was your overall reaction to what you heard?
Well, my general reaction to listening to Anthony was to get a big grin on my face. Boy, he's cute and articulate.
He is cute.
He I think that he does represent a new generation of kids who are computer savvy and who are being introduced into a internet world and a consumer world at an earlier and earlier age. But, you know, it struck me that he's practicing skills through the Webkinz, the stuffed animals, and through the internet website that are important for kids his age. You know, understanding and following instructions, knowing the rules of the game. But then there were things that worry me and just generally worry me about kids and media use at this age, and that is really, what is Webkinz designed to do? It's not necessarily designed to be educational and to be developmentally appropriate. It's designed to sell stuff, right? So they're creating consumers at an early age where they want to collect the Webkinz and they want to spend their money on these Webkinz, and they're learning about, you know, capitalist economy by going on the website and earning money so they can buy things for their Webkinz. But it's probably pretty innocuous, given that the goal of the game is to be nurturing and to be involved in these pets' lives.
Well, let me suggest something I'm worried about. You know the stereotype they have about older people and the media and, you know, the internet, they're mistrustful and so on and so forth. Well, I am that stereotype. I fit the stereotype. So I wonder about little Anthony's brain. mm-hmm. while this is going on? Because I know, as a psychologist, that in order for children to learn creativity, they need space. They need cognitive space, and they need physical space. And he's not getting that when he's playing games. Our children aren't getting that.
Yeah, I think certainly if they're doing that, consuming media, being on the web, or playing video games at the expense of doing anything else, then it's a problem. You're right. Children do need to have face-to-face interaction with other children and adults, whether it's playing games or riding bikes or participating in sports. And they need it both for their physical well-being, because certainly now we have a crisis of childhood obesity, mm-hmm. and media are in part to blame for that, but also because they need to be able to develop social skills and interaction skills that go beyond the screen. So I think the point there is that as much as we're concerned with what children are exposed to through the media, we need to be concerned with how much time they're spending looking at a screen. Deborah, the mother, said that her child spends half hour, 45 minutes a day with his webcam site, and that's probably fine. But when it gets to 6 or 7 or 8 hours a day, all the child's free time watching television, playing video games, or manipulating their social networking site, then it's worrisome.
Well, let's take a break. I want to talk about that issue of time, and we have lots of people who want to join the conversation also. So let's do both after our break. I'm talking about the media, its impact on our children's relationship with the media, and what we're learning is there's good news and bad news. Of course, my guest is Dr. Amy Jordan. She's a director of the Developing Child Center at the Annenberg School here in Philadelphia, and she's the co-author of Children and Adolescents and the Media. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY. 91 FM.
Delaware Valley Family Business Center supports WHYY and announces their September 18th Family Business Forum in Villanova, where family businesses receive tools to help them for generations of success. Details at generationsofsuccess.com.
On the next Fresh Air, why the U.S. needs to take the lead on solving global warming and how the challenge could help revive America at home and abroad. We talk with New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman. His new book is called Hot, Fat, and Crowded. Also, J.J. Abrams, co-creator of the TV series Lost, tells us about his new TV series, Fringe. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Arden Theater Company supports WHYY and presents a new version of Leonard Bernstein's musical Candide, now through October 19th. Featuring Ben Dibble, Scott Greer, and Mary Martello. Tickets at ardentheater.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about our children and the media, the impact of the media on our children's development. My guest is Dr. Amy Jordan. She's director of the media and the developing child sector at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. She's co-author of the new edition of Children, Adolescents, and the Media. Amy, before our break, we were talking about this time issue. You said the little boy Elisa interviewed, 7-year-old Anthony, was playing his video game 45 minutes a day, and you said, well, that was kind of okay, and if it went up, to 6 hours a day, that wasn't okay. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends 2 hours a day. How do they come up with that number?
Well, they recommend 2 hours a day or less, so they're not saying all
right.
children should be spending 2 hours a day
right.
with media. They also recommend that the majority of that time be spent with educational media, so parents can decide whether or not a Webkinz or a Neopets is educational. But they come up with this not because there's any singular study that suggests that 2 hours is some magical number, but when you look at the effects of time spent with media on educational achievement, childhood overweight, children's sociability, 2 hours seems to be about the right number. And in saying 2 hours, they're recognizing that some media can be beneficial for children, that media have the potential to be educational and enriching and offer children ways to be sociable with their friends and with their parents.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. Okay, we've got Carol on the line. Carol?
Hi, hello.
Hi, Carol.
I wanted to make a couple of comments, Dr. Gottlieb. I wanted to point out a couple things. First of all, we're talking a lot about the children's behavior that shows up as a result of the content that they're observing. And I think that's very important. But there's one other angle to the discussion, which is even if they're not acting out, I'm concerned about the stress that's being caused inside them. And they may be acting out in subtler ways. They're losing sleep. They're not doing well in school. And I think the stress itself, even before you get to the behavior, the direct modeling behavior that we're talking about, is something that really demands some attention. And the other point I wanted to make is that I think, you know, we're talking a lot about content-based, and that is very important as well, except for me, the medium itself is troubling. I remember reading some of Barry Brazelton's writing when my children were very small, drawing a picture of a small child sitting in front of a flickering screen, sitting inert with a lot of input coming in at them. And that disturbed me. I have my children in a Waldorf school, and the teachers have spoken to us a great deal about the effect of developing real emotions and realist responses to something that is, in fact, unreal, as opposed to the experience of relating with other human beings, being outdoors in the world, making something with their hands, all of which contain so much more human warmth than relating to a Wetkins, for example. My children are not allowed.
You're bringing up two critical points. We're having trouble with the connection, and I'm really anxious to hear Amy respond, especially to Carol's second point about, you know, real emotions in response to unreal situations.
Absolutely. Well, I think Carol brings out a good point about the medium itself, perhaps shaping children's responses and children's the way they think about the world. But I would have to argue that we can't really talk about a medium anymore. We can talk about media systems, but the mass media are so different from one another. You know, our experiences in reading a magazine or going online or watching a traditional television set are all pretty unique, and research shows that they lead to different results and have different consequences. In terms of whether or not it eliminates the ability of children to respond to real-life situations, I'm not sure that I've seen research that suggests that that's the case. You could argue the opposite, too, that children who watch on an educational program the deliberate and careful curriculum of how to, I don't know, solve a problem or how to deal with conflict, it might be a good thing. It's social learning theory suggests that if we see ways of playing out situations or scripts that we can follow that are healthy and positive, then that's something that we can carry into our own lives, whether it's health behaviors or social interactions. The problem is when it's one is to the exclusion of the other. I would agree with Carol that it's probably almost always better for people to engage in interaction face-to-face, but there are times when it's just not possible to get that kind of practice or have exposure to that.
Well, one of the themes I'm hearing is balance and supervision.
Yes.
And we haven't talked about supervision yet, but I think it was a study you did or a study you referred to in your book that talks about the impact of children sitting in front of a screen, whether or not a parent's in the room, and whether or not the parent's actually talking with them.
Yes, yes. We do talk about that in the book. It was a study that was done with Sesame Street when Sesame Street was first on the air. And the producers wanted to know, should they create storylines or bits within the program that would appeal to parents, that only parents would get? Should they bring in celebrities that only parents would know or make jokes that only parents would understand? And they found that in their studies that children learn more when they watch television with a parent in the room, whether or not the mother is actually saying anything about it. Just the fact that the parent is sitting there tells the child that this is important, that this is something my parent is interested in watching with me, and they can talk about it outside of the viewing situation. So if a parent likes to watch, let's say, American Idol with the child, he or she, just by sitting there, is saying to the child, well, this is an interesting show, but then afterwards can say, I really didn't like the way Simon talked to that contestant, or I really appreciated the fact that the contestant took that criticism to heart. Whatever it is a parent says, it helps a parent further her values or his values.
Let's go back to the lines. We've got Daniel on the line. Daniel, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi. I have a question about something that I originally thought could be a positive influence with young people, and specifically online. But now it concerns me in that on a lot of blogs or forums or image boards or something like that, there are a lot of young people, and here I would say more teenage, that express their opinions about generally inert things, you know, just what they are interested in, you know, music, movies, maybe other video games. But they often tend to, or at least that I've seen, all gravitate to the same opinion. And surely that's good to establish sort of a conversation with anonymous people who you can become friends with, but it also seems to, at least from what I am afraid I'm seeing, create sort of an inflated sense of power on the imagined space online, and it also tends to show the kids that their opinions can really boil down to what's almost like a mirror of political talking points, in that they can justify and actually feel the need to justify their interest in whatever it is that they're interested in. Okay. And I was wondering if there's ever been any research on this and whether or not that's seen as still a positive influence, that they're able to express themselves honestly with peers their own age, or whether or not the lack of diversity is sort of stagnating.
I think that's a fascinating question, Daniel. And Amy, here we are in a world where our kids are growing up, there is increased sense of alienation, and at the same time there are these vehicles where you can express yourself to the world, which is, I mean, the research I've read shows that our children are becoming more narcissistic.
Yeah. I think Daniel's point is really important, and that is that youth are going online, they are sharing their opinions, and very often they're together in this chat room or on this website because they're of like mind. The flip side of having the opportunity to put yourself out there and say what you think and sometimes be anonymous about what you think is that for teens, and this is one of the things that I really worry about with the internet, that can sometimes take the form of bullying and ostracizing sort of out-group members. And it's something that child advocates and researchers are beginning to study. So I can't really speak to research on adolescent political views online, but I can speak to some of the social norms that we're observing with youth on the internet, and the anonymity and the ability to kind of say whatever you want to say has sometimes magnified the bullying that goes on in the school halls. It leaves the school and goes right into the home and is played out on the computer. And I think this is something that parents really need to pay attention to, both in terms of making sure that the child knows that it's not okay to talk about other kids in disparaging ways on the internet because it is hurtful and harmful, but also that it's important to kind of protect yourself, knowing that whatever you say can be very quickly spread around the school. It can be cut and pasted into a document, and here's what little Susie said to Johnny, and then everybody will know. Nothing's private anymore.
One of the things that distresses me is that kids now can't trust their friends, even their best friends, especially girls. Girls have told me that it's especially bad with girls, but boys tend to do that less.
Yeah, I think whatever we see in real life, in face-to-face life, we see in virtual life. So, yes, it's always been the case that girls have been harder on one another than boys, and they have tended to be more gossipy and cliquish. But it gets amplified through websites. And I'm not sure that this is something that holds across all social groups, but I think it's important for parents to be aware there's the potential there.
Well, this sets up the question that I want to talk about after our break, which I've got to take now, but the question about what's a parent to do, what does a child need to learn, what needs to be done in the short run and in the long run. And I also want to bring up what's realistic given mm-hmm. today's technology. And that's what we're talking about today on Voices. We're talking about the media, its impact on our children, how our children use it, and what parents need to do to enhance its positive effects and mitigate its negative effects. My guest is Dr. Amy Jordan. She's director of the Media and Developing Child Sector at Annenberg Public Policy Center in Philadelphia. She's the co-author of the new edition of Children, Adolescents, and the Media. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Delaware Valley Family Business Center supports WHYY and announces their September 18th Family Business Forum in Villanova, where family businesses receive tools to help them for generations of success. Details at generationsofsuccess.com.
Next time on Day to Day.
What is this?
I don't know.
Amy Thompson taught children with autism.
But her work took on a whole new dimension when she became the mother of an autistic son.
He knows when I'm having a difficult time. He'll come put his arms around me and he'll say, Mama, I love you.
One mom's fight for her autistic child.
I've never seen that side of autism, that capacity to love somebody fully.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. WHYY gratefully acknowledges our corporate underwriters and would like to add your business or organization to our diverse list of supporters. To become a WHYY underwriter, please call 215-351-1223.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the media and our children's relationship with the media, what it does to them and what it does for them. Dr. Amy Jordan is my guest. She's director of the Media and Developing Child Center at Annenberg. She's the co-author of the new edition of Children, Adolescents, and the Media. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Carl on the line.
Hi,
Carl.
I'm interested. A previous caller mentioned that her children go to Waldorf school and that she doesn't allow much media exposure. And myself going to an alternative school years ago, I knew lots of kids who weren't allowed to watch TV. And whenever they went to a friend's house, they would just be mesmerized, you know, in front of a TV. And I'm wondering what Dr. Jordan feels is like the optimum exposure to media as far as allowing children to gain, you know, perspective on what media is,
mm-hmm.
and not to be, you know, become a victim of it.
Yeah.
Well, the word you use, Amy, is media literacy.
Yeah, I liked the caller Carol who said that her children go to Waldorf schools. Waldorf schools have parents sign pledges that their children won't watch television. I'm not sure what their policy is on other media, and this is at least during the school week. And it's so much easier for kids to abide by those kinds of guidelines if all of their peers are doing the same thing. Otherwise, it becomes a kind of forbidden fruit effect where they may not be allowed to play a particular video game at one house, but as soon as they go over to their friend's house, boy, they're all over that game. So I think that's why it's important for parents to recognize that this is something that's really appealing to kids. Kids really like the media. They like going online. They like watching television. And I believe it's our job as parents and teachers and people who care about the welfare of children to help them understand what media can and can't do for them and help them develop a sense of aesthetics, what's good, what's not good television, and boundaries, you know, how much is too much. Because in the absence of that, they're kind of flailing around trying to figure out, you know, the best way to make media work for them.
Well, I got to ask you the hard question. How? How do we do all those things, Amy?
Well, I think one of the most important things is for parents to be media savvy themselves. We're going through a transition now where this generation of parents kind of grew up at the very early stages of internet and video on demand and a lot of things that are available to our kids we didn't have available as children. So we're kind of playing catch up, and our children are much more fearless with media than we are, certainly. But it's important to understand what the internet is and what these games are. Anthony's mother was very wise in understanding what webkins are and what Anthony does and how much time he's spending. So I think that's really important, understanding what kids are doing online and with media. And to do that, it means consuming it with them, you know, watching television shows with them, picking out DVDs with them.
Yeah, and that's hard to do in these days when most homes have at least one television for every human in the house.
Dan, most homes have four televisions. It's quite astonishing. The average home today has four television sets, has multiple computers, has access to hundreds of channels through cable and satellite. So they really are kind of scattered throughout the home. They're ubiquitous through the home.
Yeah, when I was a kid, our family used to argue over which TV, which channel.
Right.
We were going to watch. It was great. You mm-hmm. know, it was great. Well, except I always lost, but just a younger brother thing. But then, you know, the principle of it, you know, there's interaction there.
Yeah, you had a chance to state your case and argue your point. But today, if children or teenagers really want to watch their own show, they can just go into another room, or if they want to go online, they can go on to another. And wireless computer.
And I just watched. I went to a baseball game with my son-in-law, and, you know, he saw the phone I had, and he pushed a couple buttons. He was watching television on my phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, media have really converged. So some used to say that television is going away, and the truth is that television is going everywhere.
Yeah.
And if the child wants to watch a show that's forbidden or blocked by a V-chip on a television set, he or she can watch it online. And I think that's where it's important to make sure that dialogue and discussion is open, that we're talking, we're not just saying, no, you can't, but saying, here's how I feel about it. This is why I think it's important that you wait a few years before you watch a horror film or an R-rated movie. And I think it's also important to respect our children's interests. You know, the interviewer of Anthony, I think she was so effective because Anthony wants to be able to talk about what he's doing. I mean, it's empowering and exciting for him that he's in this world and that an adult doesn't understand it and he gets to explain it. And it's a really nice way for parents to connect to their kids.
You know,
say, tell me about that.
You know what, Amy? This dialogue you're suggesting is exactly the same dialogue I had with my girls in high school about drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's
every topic needs these dialogues.
Yeah.
Whether it's sex or drugs or the violence that we see in the world around us or media or some combination.
Right. Well, I have to admit my father's conversation with daughters about sex is less open, free-flowing.
Well, you know, Dan, they may be rolling their eyes, but they're hearing you.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Elizabeth on the line. Elizabeth, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there, can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay, hi. We have very little television in my household. We keep our We have one TV. We keep it in a cabinet. The only thing we use it for is my husband and I will put in a little video for an hour or so at night, and that's it. We have a 21-month-old son who does not watch any television. And overall, we are very happy with the situation. I definitely noticed that we're out of touch with popular culture. It makes us a little weird. For my husband and I, we've chosen that. We accept being a little weird, and that's fine. My son goes to daycare full-time, and I know that he knows Elmo, and I know that as he gets older, he's going to become more and more aware of aspects of popular culture that he's not familiar with. And, you know, my husband and I have chosen to abstain, and that makes us a little weird, and we've made that choice, but he has not made that choice.
Well, so you're almost at your question. What is it?
Well, I guess my question is, what is the impact of keeping him away from the influences that affect all of his peers, and is it a problem? And, you know, is it fair to make him be the weirdo?
Well, before we hear the real expert, I'll tell you that in nature there are no rights and wrongs, only decisions and consequences. So let's hear what Amy has to say.
I think I would agree with that. You know, I think for many parents who restrict their children's media use, it's a hard thing to do, and it's something that they're proud of, and they should be proud of it. But you'll find as your son gets older that he's going to chafe against that, and particularly when he gets to be about the age of 10, 11, 12, he really doesn't want to be a little weird. It's really important for kids to feel like they can fit in. But that doesn't mean that he needs to sit down and watch television to fit in. You know, there are other ways of knowing about popular culture without being able to, you know, dissect the latest episode of 24. So I think being able to look at TV guides or read some of these entertainment magazines and listen to music is fine. But you want to be able to listen to your child and what he's feeling he's missing and why you, as a parent, have chosen to eliminate that or restrict that from his life. He needs to know your reasons, I think, is the most important.
Well, and as a clinician and family therapist, I'll say in general, rules need to be there. They need to be clear. But the more rigid the rule is, the more dangerous.
Yeah, we've actually found in studies of parental mediation of television that parents with the most rigid rules have children that watch the most age-inappropriate content because they're sneaking it.
And yeah, and that's the case with everything. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your call. Let's go back to Alyssa's interview with Anthony's mom, Jennifer, that we spoke to in the beginning of the show. In this piece of the interview, Alyssa spoke with Jennifer about the future role the internet will play in her children's lives.
You see how, again, going back to when you were a child and just the development of the internet and just how it's expanded, I would imagine that there's so many more issues and so many more concerns that are out there. I guess as they get older and as it becomes more and more a part of their daily lives and MySpace and Facebook and the pressures from their friends to be on these social networking sites, how do you plan to deal with that as a parent?
Well, I'd hate to call myself the boring mom, but I'm pretty strict when it comes to that stuff. You know, I understand there are kids with my daughter, kids her age that are on MySpace, but as much as she doesn't want to hear it, she's not getting one. You know, I think the internet's okay for certain things, but as for the social networking for kids that age, I don't believe in it.
That was Jennifer, Anthony's mom, who spoke with Lisa Walters earlier. What are your thoughts about what you heard, Amy?
I have to admit, Dan, I didn't hear the interview for whatever reason. Since I'm on the phone, it didn't come through.
Oh, I wonder if it came through to the rest of our listeners. Let's go back to something you raised about what to do about it and how to restrict and whether to restrict. One of your recommendations is to identify non-screen in-home activities that are pleasurable to kids, for example.
Yeah, I think that because our children have grown up with media, they often turn to media as a default. Like, this is what they're going to do if they have free time. And I think at an early age, it's important for parents to engage in play because that's how they connect with their children during the first few years of life, whether it's building with blocks or playing with sand and water, and those sorts of tactile play is important. But I think as kids get older, it's harder for them to think of alternative activities that are more compelling than watching TV or a DVD or going on the internet. And I know this can be true in my home, and it was true in studies that we did here at the University of Pennsylvania. When we said to parents, look, let's say that you cut media out of your children's lives or you reduce it to 2 hours a day or less, what would you tell your child to do? And parents often said, well, I tell them to organize that closet or clean up his room or do his homework. So it wasn't as attractive as actually watching TV or being on the internet. So it does take some creativity, and there's a wonderful organization that sponsors the TV Free Week every year. It occurs during the second or third week of April, depending on when Easter is falling. And they have a list of about 100 alternative activities that kids can do, whether it's helping a parent prepare a dinner, which is fun for kids who are in their early years, 6, 7, 8 years old, or doing activities outside, or even doing activities that are related to media that aren't consuming media, like drawing Elmo.
Does that cover older kids, too?
Yeah, it gets more challenging as teens get older and they have preferences for how they want to use their time, but and they have more demands on their time because of extracurricular activities and schoolwork. Yeah, it's harder, but I think it speaks to the need to stay in touch with our kids and what they like to do.
What's that website, Amy?
It's the organization is, it used to be called TV Free America. Now it's called Screen Free America. And people can go on it, and it's a .org. It's not a commercial site, and they have a lot of really great ideas.
So no any evidence that any of these kids have been harmed through this abrupt detox?
Actually, I have talked to several school districts that have participated in it. It's usually a school-wide effort where screen media are eliminated except for schoolwork for an entire week. And the world opens up. At first, there's some resistance, like, oh, what am I going to do with my time and boredom? But then they start to find that they're interested in reading.
I think that's great. Unfortunately, we're running out of time and can't develop it. We're talking about screenfreemedia.org. We've been talking with Dr. Amy Jordan, who's director of the Media and Developing Child Center in Annenberg. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of radio content. Mike and Scott's the executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Elisa Walters and Gita Simons. Elisa directed today's show. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Enjoy your week, my friends.